this week on Capitalism, Race and Democracy.
This is not a threat against the Middle East only. It's a threat against the world and even the labor class in the United States. This is to impose slavery on labor class in the United States. We have to look at it like that.
The U.S.-Israeli war on Iran is a threat against all of humanity.
Sean O'Brien again, asleep at the wheel or severely stupid. I don't know which, but either way, it's bad news for us Teamsters supporting him.
UPS truck drivers denounce the use of AI infrared cameras in the cabs of trucks as a serious health issue for drivers throughout the country.
We feel that either the working class, the oppressed people take a stand against these new colonial policies that Trump's playing against Latin America, or we'll go into a new colonial situation once again.
Brazilian oil workers rally in defense of the Cuban Revolution. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. The U.S.-Israeli war on Iran threatens the people of the entire region. Shamal Ali is a leader of the working-class organization Communist Party of Iran Hekmatist. He says that war in Iran is not only an attack on Iran, but an attack on all of humanity. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Shamal, why don't you talk first about your position leading up to this war, because I know your organization, although it's opposed to the Iranian government, has said that you were opposed to the war and the attack by the United States on Iran.
Exactly, because we are facing maybe another scenario, another Iraqi scenario that we've seen what's happened with Iraq. I mean, this time is a little bit different. The United States is only attacking, bombing, actually not with the military, with the boots on the ground, as they say. However, it's only about more chaos, more sectarian, or the same scenario has happened in Iraq is about to happen in Iran. I mean, the people in Iran is against the current regime, capitalist Islamic Republic of Iran. And they actually have struggled for 47 years. They never gave up to protest against all the oppressions and bourgeois imperialist power in Iran. But this war will only help the right-wing and fascist forces inside Iran. And this will turn the society. I mean, actually, it will break down the very social fabric in Iran. And people will be afraid and they will run for their lives instead of struggling for more freedom and equality. And that's why we've been against the Islamic regime in Iran. We have many communists and socialists and working labor activists has lost their life in the struggle against this regime. But when it's coming to a war like the fascist war of Israel and United States against Iran, we cannot have other than a very condemned position, or I mean, we have to stand against this war, and we have to be, as well as all the socialists and the labor forces all over the world, against this aggression, and we have to cry and to demand to stop this war immediately.
And of course, the fascist government of Trump is just invaded, attacked Venezuela. They want to attack Cuba. They also are aiming at China and stopping oil from Iran. What is going to be the effect on the Middle East and the world with the destruction that's taking place by Israel and the United States in Iran and the Middle East?
I mean, the outcome is clear. I mean, 2 days ago, Reza Pahlavi, the guy that United States want to appoint as a leader, as a king, and to bring back the monarchy in Iran, is the person that should take his father's place in Iran, has called the military to attack Kurdish people and all the people who demand some kind of freedom or maybe self-determination inside Iran. And this only show you that what's happening in Iran in future is another fascist regime. And this time it will be with support of United States and Israel. I mean, Israel and United States will want to have control in the Middle East. They want to control the people to impose their fascist ideas about human rights and that type of freedom that they call for, it, which is freedom of capitalists and freedom of the capitalist class, not for people. It's that they want to impose on Middle East, but actually the outcome will not even be that be a stable region under this type of control. The region will be, as I said, we can see the same scenario that happened in Iraq in a very large scale. Now, Iran is about 80 million people, and there is many forces supported by different reactionary and different dictatorship in the region, and fascists in the region, like Pakistan, like Saudi Arabia, like Israel, even Turkey, to make a chaos in Iran and turn it to a battlefield when everybody fighting everybody. I mean, this is the scenario that's coming about, but it's not inevitable. I mean, people still in Iran have a long history of struggling for freedom and equality. There is a very strong labor movement, and even it's not illegal, but there is some type of organization among workers and laborers, and this will have to, and they cannot do anything other than standing against this situation and try to organize themselves and fight back for their freedom and humanity. The situation is very dangerous. It's not dangerous only for the Middle East. I mean, this type of aggression, that will be the new international law. If you have power, you can do whatever you like, whatever you need. That type of international law that we had before, it was a part of a package which contained some type of human rights too. But now we are facing a situation where all this will be, I mean, something in past, and we might find ourselves in the 19th century like capitalism, when people should work like slaves and without any rights. I mean, this is not a threat against Middle East only. It's a threat against the world, and even the labor class in the United States will face that situation. This is to impose slavery on labor class in United States. We have to look at it like that, and that's why the labor class in United States and all over the world should be part of this struggle to support Iranian people, to support working class in people, to be against the war, and at the same time to have solidarity with Iranian people against their brutal regime too.
And the role of Zionism, as you know, the Zionists have a big influence in the United States. Netanyahu's come to the U.S. Congress many times and attacked the American people for opposing the Israeli repression and genocide of the Palestinians. And the genocide supported by the United States in Gaza has actually expanded with pogroms in the West Bank and now the bombing of many other countries in the Middle East. The project of Israel in supporting the Iraq war, there was a committee called the Committee to Liberate Iraq with George Shultz, American capitalist. He was head of Bechtel at one time. It seems that U.S. imperialism and the fascist government of Trump now are aligned with the Zionist project and expanding Israel's power and its control of the Middle East. Is that what is going on?
I mean, whatever was our position against Zionism, I mean, myself, I have been against that movement all of my life. But what we see in Israel is more than that. Like you can call it Zionism 2.0. I mean, something that is more fascist and more brutal than even the type of reactionary movement which we've been seeing, the catastrophic of their deed in Palestine and Middle East. I mean, Israel were backing the reactionary, the despotic government in Middle East, and they were against all the left and freedom-loving people in this region. But this what we've seen in this time, in this period of time is more than that. Is actually a fascist force that want everybody to see how it's legal and justified to kill children, thousands of children. I mean, and they streamed live to everybody. I mean, whenever you are about to see an image from Palestine, a part of your humanity is dying. That's what we see in Middle East, and that's what we facing now. We can call Israel and what they doing in Gaza and in Palestine like a laboratory for fascism all over the world. They want to let people be the new normal, which is normal to kill people just because they not belong to your race and to your religion or to your ethnic group. It's justified in that ideology. I mean, the fascist government of Trump supporting Israel because they are of the same kind, and they what they want to bring about, it's not a secret. If you ask tech billionaires in Silicon Valley, they will tell you that democracy is past, that we don't need democracy anymore. We need a monarchy. We need a king, and Trump should be president for life, and they should have the power, and they will not allow even another kind of capitalist like in Democratic Party to come to power again. This is what they plan to find. I mean, this war in Iran is a war. You can call it the war against humanity. It's not only against the labor class, but the labor class is the only force that can stop them, can actually force them to set back.
That was Shamal Ali talking about the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran and what it means in the region and the world. Next, we hear from Iranian-American peace activist Bahman Azad with the U.S. Peace Council and the United National Anti-War Coalition. He spoke on Sunday, March 1st, at the meeting of the International Manifesto Group.
First of all, I would like to call this, what we are witnessing, what the U.S. imperialism is doing, is indeed crime against humanity. And it should be condemned as such. It's not a question of violation of some country's national territories or borders or independence or anything like that. It's far, far beyond that. And we have kind of degraded the whole political scene and the international scene to a level that people brag about changing regimes, assassinating leaders of the countries, inviting people of other countries to rise against their governments, as if nothing has existed in terms of international law ever. And this needs to be addressed in a most strongest objectionable way. And we should do that, and we should not wait any minute and pull any punches about that, because we are dealing with a very serious issue. And I call it the crime against humanity because, again, it isn't a conflict between Israel and Iran. It's not a conflict between United States and Israel on the one hand and Iran on the other. It's not a regional issue. It is an international issue. And we are dealing with aspects of it in different places, as we are witnessing similar pattern going on in Latin America and the Caribbean. Because if you look at the whole situation, the whole dynamics is based on the fact that U.S. imperialism is losing its hegemony over the global situation. It is seeing that coming, its fall coming. It is seeing that two major areas of the world, which is West Asia, Middle East, and Latin America, are two centers of resistance against U.S. hegemony. They know that losing any of them, even one of them, would mean the total collapse of the imperialist system. And as a result, it seems from their class point of view, they have no choice but commit any crime they can if they want to maintain their hegemony. And what we are witnessing here in the Middle East and what is happening in Iran right now is a result of that. So it's not Israel moving United States in that direction based on its own interests. Israel is an outpost of United States in the Middle East. Its purpose is to do what it's doing. Israel cannot push any policy on the U.S. Israeli lobby in the U.S. is successful only if its policy is in line with the U.S. policy. If it is in conflict with it, it's U.S. policy that goes forward, not the Israeli policy. So we have to be careful about giving too much value to what Israel is doing and too little to what the U.S. is doing. Secondly, it's not a crazy leader or president or anything doing this. It's not even a single party doing this. It's the U.S. ruling class that is being threatened, and it's acting in quite a well-coordinated way. All these objections to what Trump is doing is not about the policy, it's about how he's doing it. And what the objections are is, okay, it's not a good time, it's not a good method, you're not doing it right and all that, but nothing about U.S. imperialism should not do any of this. So in that sense, we are dealing with the whole ruling class of the United States, regardless of the party, that is seeing the threat of its own collapse, the collapse of its hegemony, and it's uniting, although there are differences because the world situation is complex and not all the time one single party or one group can be correct in terms of how to approach it. In a sense, there are these conflictual situations are normal between these parties, but this is over how to do it and not whether or not to do it. And that's the issue. And we should organize the whole of humanity in that sense as much as we can, broadest possible. Not be picky about who we deal with right now, whether it's religious, whether it's nationalist, whether whatever. We should put aside those differences. And it's for the sake of humanity that they should put an end to this imperialist adventure and crime and save humanity from the disasters that are awaiting us if these guys manage to do what they have to do.
That was Iranian-American peace activist Bahman Azad speaking at the International Manifesto Group meeting on March 1st, 2026. That was Barpa Kiz, El Pueblo Unido Jamás Será Vencido, Iranian version. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Fabio Bosco is a retired subway operator in Sao Paulo, a veteran trade unionist and organizer with the labor federation CSP Con Lutas, the popular trade union center, as well as the PSTU, Partido Socialista dos Trabalhadores Unificado, a political party in Brazil. He spoke to Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke about Brazilian oil workers trying to assist in the defense of the Cuban Revolution, Brazilian politics, and many other topics. This is part one of that interview. Part two will air on an upcoming program.
Welcome, Fabio, again to Pacifica Radio and Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. Please tell our audience in the United States and around the world something of your background and experience as a union agitator and militant in contemporary Brazil.
Look, I have been a union activist for 40 years. And here in Brazil, it was a very interesting moment because I started when the dictatorship in Brazil was weak And then it was overthrown. And then the working class achieved the democratic rights, which we are fighting to keep all of them up to our days. So I have been active during all these years. And in the beginning, I was also involved in the foundation of the Workers' Party, which is the party led by current President Lula da Silva. But then some years later, there was a struggle in Brazil to impeach the President Collor de Mello. We supported this struggle, but the Workers' Party did not want to support it because they believed that we should stick ourselves to the electoral rules. And so former President Collor de Mello should have his 4 years term respected. But that was not the opinion of the youth and great part of the working class. We joined then, and then we were expelled from the Workers' Party, and we founded the Unified Socialist Workers' Party.
To be clear, the coup d'etat that brought the Brazilian military into power in 1964, supported by American CIA and imperialist forces, lasted until the late 80s, correct? So you're speaking about...
It lasted 20 years, yes.
And so when Collor Mellor, when was he president?
He was the first elected president after the dictatorship in 1989. He won the election for a very small margin to Lula da Silva. And so he started his term in 1990.
Please describe briefly the current government of the Federative Republic of Brazil, with its current president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, now serving in his third term, correct?
Perfect.
Separated by a jail term and another of his colleagues succeeding him, Dina's, you'll correct me. And then, of course, she being impeached as well, correct?
Yes, that's it. Look, Brazil, we are a kind of semi-colonial country regarding the major imperialist powers, the US, the European powers, nowadays China as well. At the same time, in South America, Brazil plays a role, a kind of imperialist role regarding our neighbors. You see, the Brazilian economy has, in the last years, I mean, the last 20 years at least, there is a process of deindustrialization. It's relative. So we are losing everything that has more to do with technologies, but at the same time, everything that's connected to agribusiness are developing in Brazil. So the Brazilian administrations, both the Workers' Party or the right-wing ones, they more or less they do the same thing. They try to create a space for Brazilian products in the world markets. You see, selling for the best price to whoever agrees to buy it. Today, the Brazilian products find room mainly in China and the US. So the Brazilian administration is always playing with both. So Lula da Silva and his predecessors, they do more or less the same. They try to keep all good relations with any US administration, as well as with the Chinese administration, in order to keep these exports going on. So that's the situation we have today. It's a capitalist country. The country is rich, but the majority of the people are poor. The situation of the working class is getting worse. But we are struggling, you see. And when there is struggle, there is hope. And that's our job here, to organize the working class independently regarding the government, regarding the bosses, in order to defend our rights and fight for workers' power.
Describe what you know of recent actions and declarations of the Petrobras Oil Workers Union regarding the threats to the Cuban Revolution posed by the renewed offensive, including new sanctions by the Trump government, as well as increased military presence in the Caribbean, that is clearly trying once again to starve and destroy the socialist property forms that are defended by the Cuban working class and the current Cuban government.
Look, the oil workers unions in Brazil, there are 18 unions. The main one is the Rio de Janeiro Union. You see, it's the strongest one. And it's also where the headquarters of the Brazilian oil company Petrobras is. And they had a very good stand. We are very happy with them because what they are talking about, they want the Brazilian oil company Petrobras and Lula administration to send oil to Cuba. And yesterday they held a demonstration, a rally in front of the headquarters, and they deliver a letter. All oil workers union together with some labor federations, we were there as well, and some social movements as well, deliver a letter to Petrobras asking them to send oil to Cuba. And you know, the Brazilian oil production is large these days. Brazil became one of the 10 major producers of oil. So less than 1 week of Brazilian production is more than enough for the 1 year of Cuba's consumption. So we are raising demands that are very possible, you see, but it needs the willingness by the Brazilian government and Petrobras administration to challenge what Donald Trump is doing against Cuba. And Thomas, may I say something else that I think it's something important and beautiful. Look, this oil workers union, since the genocide started against the Palestinians carried out by the state of Israel, backed by the U.S. and all imperialist powers, this oil workers union, they have been raising the issue that Brazil should stop the oil exports to Israel, you see? I think that's very important because, look, here in Brazil, unfortunately, the majority of the labor movement, they did not take a clear stand against the genocide, the ongoing genocide in Palestine. But this oil workers union of Rio de Janeiro, they raised this issue. They demanded Petrobras and Lula da Silva administration to stop sending oil. And what happened last year? Petrobras started to do something like this. It was a kind of oil exports in disguise. They export oil to Italy, and from Italy, the oil goes to Israel. It's Brazilian oil. You see, it's Brazilian oil. And the union is clearly opposing that. So I think that it's something that inspires all of us because it's important. The working class is an international class, you see? And so we must have international statements, international stands. And this oil workers union, I think in these two cases, that are two very important cases, the genocide in Palestine and the blockage against Cuba, they are having a very good stand. And we are very happy that they are raising these questions.
When you mentioned selling oil to Cuba, I just looked up the world market price for oil right now is around $66 US dollars per barrel. This, of course, fluctuates. You know, if bombs start dropping in Iran, I'm sure it's going to skyrocket to over $100 a barrel. So, you know, That's the spot market price, as we say. The Soviet Union, when it was in existence, was selling Cuban oil or selling Cuba oil at below market rates, usually tied to the cost of production. I assume the Brazilian Petrobras workers are saying something similar, that, you know, that the rate of oil, because I have no idea what, for example, Venezuela or Mexico was charging Cuba for oil shipments. I assumed it was something close to the world market price. Can you say anything about that?
Look, I'll tell you what I know. I know that Venezuela was trading oil in exchange for the expertise of Cuban doctors that are currently working in Venezuela. So it was a kind of exchange. I don't know how they measure that in terms of currencies, you see?
Yes.
Look, what we want is that Brazil, as an emergency, should send the oil and then see what kind of agreement it's possible. I think Cuba will have many difficulties today to deliver, to pay this oil prices, $66 per barrel. So Brazil should do something that on the one side meets the needs of the Cuban people, on the other side that is affordable for them. But I cannot tell you how much it would be. What I can assure you is that the cost of production and exports is much less than $66 per barrel. So I think there is a big margin of bargaining, you see?
Undoubtedly.
But even we believe that you must send the oil first and then make the arrangements for how much Cuba can pay.
Obviously, the oil workers have no control over necessarily shipping, containers of liquid crude oil. A question about the Brazilian politics. It seems to me the Partido Trabajadores, the PT, now, as you said earlier, of which you were one of the founders, but is now headed by Lula and others, is a leading a coalition or popular front government in the Congress. Lula, of course, is the president, serving 4-year terms. Correct? He's the head of government as well, but the Congress relies on a coalition of working class parties and bourgeois parties. Is that safe to say? Correct? Okay.
Perfect. The bourgeois parties are the majority, you see, but it's the Lula administration is a coalition between the Workers' Party and some other left-wing parties like the Communist Party of Brazil and the Party for Solidarity and Freedom, PSOL, and bourgeois parties. You see, there is a coalition that keeps the government.
Okay. I say that because it seems to me that the PT is similar to Britain's United Kingdom's Labour Party, in that it was, at least from its founding, it stated its ambition to bring socialism to Britain through evolution and reform, not revolution. And it does have a substantial membership in the working class, just like the PT does. And yet the program and leadership are making compromises and deals that will assist in the function of Brazilian capitalism, especially in the face of U.S. imperialism. I say that because whenever, of course, U.S. imperialism becomes uglier than usual to Latin American countries, it seems like the entire society sort of becomes, you know, animated in a nationalist self-defense. Go ahead.
Yes, I agree with you. I would like to bring some examples of this. I think the comparison with the Labour Party, in the sense that it's a party that has its origin in the working class, and originally it had a more, how can I say, militant perspective. You see, the Workers' Party in Brazil, it was like this. The leadership, the majority of the leadership were reformists. You see, they believe in this evolutionary perspective to overcome capitalism or to humanize capitalism. But there was also a revolutionary wing. The revolutionary wing was expelled and others left the Workers' Party. So today, it's basically a reformist party. They stand for the democratic rights inside this capitalist framework. Okay, so they want to reform. But the fact is that since the end of the dictatorship, half of the time the Workers' Party was in power, and other half of the time bourgeois parties were ruling. And the fact is that the situation of the working class is getting worse, you see? So I think that for the working class, this kind of administration does not work in order to provide better jobs, better wages, better living conditions for the majority of the working class. But they have some programs for the very, very, very poor, very modest programs. You see, they are popular here in Brazil. They are important for people to survive, but they are not a solution for this capitalist backlash that we are living. Regarding the relationship with Trump administration, Thomas, unfortunately, what we see is that not only Lula da Silva, but no government here in Latin America want to challenge Trump, you see? All of them, they try to accommodate. Mm. For instance, what Trump did against Venezuela. Look, it's a shame. It's a shame. Trump decided to block Venezuela, to steal the oil, and now the Chavista regime is collaborating with Trump. But look, Brazilian administration, Brazil is the largest country in Latin America. They should take a stand and say, look, Trump cannot do that. Trump cannot steal the oil of Venezuela and decide for whom this oil will be delivered. But what Brazil do, Brazilian administration do, they raise some criticism, you see? They raise some criticism, but they don't want to challenge. How to challenge? For instance, today, to send the oil to Cuba is a way to challenge Trump, you see? But there is no willingness for that. On the opposite, in the case of Brazil, we'll have national elections in October. And what the strategists behind Lula da Silva, what they believe, it's good to keep Trump like this, you see? Have this friendly relationship with Trump in order to prevent Trump from doing what he did in Argentina. In Argentina, Trump sent $20 billion to help Argentina. And this was instrumental for the election of Javier Milei. So what Lula is
concerned, I thought the money stayed in New York and simply paid back the owners of Argentine debt in New York, did it not?
No. Yes, I think not.
In other words, the money stayed with his friends, the American capitalist class, but it bought Milei, right?
Yes, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So what Lula is trying to do is to keep these friendly relations with Trump in order to pave the way for his re-election in October. So he does not want to challenge Trump. And what we see is that the same thing happened with every and each Latin American government. You see, they don't want to challenge Trump. So we feel that either the working class, the oppressed people take a stand against these new colonial policies that Trump is playing against Latin America, or we will become a new colonial. We'll go into a new colonial situation once again. That's our feeling. So as Labor Federation, we believe that we need to unite the working class across Latin America and fight back Trump. You see, we may lose, okay, but we must stand up and fight back.
That was veteran trade unionist and political militant Fabio Bosco from the Brazilian Labor Federation CSP Com Lutas, the Popular Trade Union Center, and PSTU, Partido Socialista dos Trabalhadores Unificado, a political party. He spoke to CRD's Thomas O'Rourke.
Viva Palestina, baixo sionismo. Viva Palestina, baixo sionismo. Viva, viva, viva Palestina. Viva, viva, viva Palestina. Viva Palestina, baixo sionismo. Viva Palestina, baixo sionismo. Cuidamos do solo. Colhemos o trigo,
colhemos o trigo.
Escolhemos os limões,
escolhemos os limões.
Fazemos azeite,
fazemos azeite.
O mundo inteiro sabe sobre a nossa terra.
O mundo inteiro sabe sobre a nossa terra.
Viva, viva, viva.
That was Viva Palestina, the Brazilian version of Leve Palestina, Cofia. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. The use of AI-equipped infrared surveillance cameras inside truck cabs has become a growing concern for drivers across the country. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke with Teamsters President Sean O'Brien about the technology. O'Brien initially denied that such cameras were installed in UPS trucks.
I was going to ask you about the cameras in the cabs.
Right.
The AI cameras in the cabs.
For who?
Can you ask?
For who?
On the Teamsters.
Yeah, we fight that. Yeah, we fight them. There's no cameras in UPS.
You think they should be in the cabs?
No, they shouldn't. No, they shouldn't. And they're not. Contractually, they're not.
No cameras?
No.
There's no infrared cameras?
No, there's no. There might be Lytx, but they can't use it for discipline, and they're not filming you.
But
so I don't.
Your eyes 60, 70 hours a week.
Yeah, well, you know what? They're not using it for discipline. There are no actual cameras facing in there. It's all contractually negotiated.
That was Teamster President Sean O'Brien on the use of AI-equipped infrared surveillance cameras inside truck cabs. Steve Zeltzer also spoke to Eric Johnson, a long-haul UPS driver in Montana, who says he has experienced serious health problems related to the technology.
Wow.
So, first of all, are there cameras at UPS?
Absolutely there are. There's just, you know, it's either two different things. I think it's a little bit of both. Either Sean O'Brien as a labor leader is extremely incompetent and out of touch with the workforce, or he's ignorant on all facts and questions that you asked him about the cameras. Because first off, it's called the Lytx camera. It's sold as a Lytx camera. It's put into fleets all across the country as a camera. And if Sean and any of his negotiating team, which he contractually says they're not a camera in the truck, would have done their job properly, they would have pulled at least one patent. We pulled all the patents on these trucks, right? And you know what we found out? They all refer to them as a camera, not a sensor. All cameras have sensors, but not any camera is a sensor. This is just word salad and playing semantics with words so they could dance around the contract. As far as people not being disciplined, I'd beg to differ. They must be looking at us in the cab, and myself included, because only if they were looking at you through an interior camera would they be able to tell certain things and functions you were doing out throughout the course of the day. And many people have been brought in on the carpet. They call it coaching opportunities. They're watching you, they're spying you, they're stealing our biometrics. This was all done in a lawsuit in the state of Illinois, many UPS drivers were involved in it, where they got compensation because they Lytics literally stole the biometrics and sold it on the market. And this is illegal by Illinois state law. So Sean O'Brien, again, asleep at the wheel or severely stupid. I don't know which, but either way, it's bad news for us Teamsters supporting him. And as far as him not knowing, well, let's see. I started back in the fall of 23, in October to be exact, contacting the IBT, calling, speaking to industrial hygienist, which then, oh yeah, real nice and cordial. We'll receive some of your information as soon as you start sending them some scientific information, having some proof saying that there's drivers that have grave concerns, people that have having all sorts of issues with these things. They kick it down the road. They kick you over to technology. I talked to their head of technology. So, and I'll just name drop so people know I'm not BS, and I've got emails, phone calls, text messages, all to prove and back up what I'm saying. Unlike Sean O'Brien, I bring the receipts. Talked to Anjali DeGrasse. She kicked it down the road to Tim McDonald. She was the industrial hygienist with the Teamsters. Tim McDonald, he didn't even return my phone calls or emails for a couple of months. So I chronically called and emailed and bugged the IBT's 800 number online. And then he called me while he was on vacation, and he started just saying, you know, oh, hey, I'm sorry I wasn't available. Send me all your stuff. And all he did was give me a thumbs up and okay, got it. Never did a single thing. So then I called and complained some more, and we were bringing our grievance forward. Well, they put me in touch with the head of their health and safety committee, Todd Robinson. He's still in that position today, I think. And he was horrible towards us. He was incredulous. He was demeaning. He spoke down to me and another colleague that were on the line with him. And it was almost like they were being combative with us. So not only do you have to fight UPS and the company you work for with these issues, and multiple Teamster barns have these cameras in them, and or a variety of them that if it's not a Lytics, it's another brand that uses infrared. And so they know this is an issue. And then I went one step further, you know, just to make sure that I did everything I could on my end with moving this forward with a safety grievance, with moving it forward through federal agencies like OSHA and NIOSH. I put out an email, and I attached out an email like 100 some odd guys that had issues with these cameras, medical and otherwise, with their sight, with their vision, with different issues, headaches, all sorts of things, and put their email addresses, put all of this information that we had in PDF files, and sent it off to the head of technology and the head of safety and health, and to Sean O'Brien and locals around the country. We didn't get one response, not one response for the upper echelon of the O'Brien administration, not a phone call, not a returned email or a text or anything. And even further than that, my local, which did support us pretty well, our principal officer, Jim Sumas, and our business agent, Darren Davis, I helped them and assisted them to bring forward a grievance with this. We're still working on one. We have one pending, withdrawn with rights for more information. The IBT wouldn't even reach out to those guys who were officers in the union, wouldn't return phone calls, wouldn't look at any of our information, give us any help or feedback. So here's what I find really unnerving. Sean O'Brien and his whole administration couldn't help us with this issue, didn't think we had anything. But for the past 2 years, Steve, we've had NIOSH do an in-depth scientific investigation. That means interviews, surveys, pulled scientific facts that they've had, and the last final hurdle they need to proceed with before wrapping up their investigation, which is coming to an end, is to do an on-site investigation into these cameras. And you know why they want to do an on-site test? Because they found the information so credible that we gathered, because we actually raised money on our by ourselves, because the union that we pay dues to wouldn't represent us, almost $8,000 in total was spent in shipping and buying Lytx cameras online and wiring them up and sending them to a laboratory and paying for the lab results. So we got the irradiance test on these things. We found out the joules on these things of the exposure limits that we're being exposed to. We found out the nanometer ratings. We gave them the proper distances by measuring it in the cab, and they were able to simulate this in the lab, and they were the lab tests were quite damning. I couldn't really decipher them because I'm not a scientist, but when I forwarded them over to NIOSH, who has scientists, they found it so compelling, they want to do an on-site investigation, and they've been totally stonewalled. UPS now for months has not returned a phone call or an email or anything. And it's down to the last 2 weeks. If we don't hear anything from the last 2 weeks, NIOSH is going to take our cameras that are same model and series number, the Lytx 300 SF series and the 400 SF series. They're going to perform all their tests. They're going to write an evaluation. And this evaluation will determine how these things are handled in the workplace in the future. Because if people don't know, NIOSH is an investigative branch of OSHA, and they're going to write recommendations, because I was already told verbally from everything that we currently have in front of NIOSH right now, other than this on-site investigation of them of themselves looking at these cameras, they feel that a driver is overexposed to these cameras if they're behind them 60, 70 hours a week. In all reality, nobody should be in front of these cameras for more than 15 minutes and be safe, because they have it based on it should be safe for most people in good health, not on certain medications and supplements, for an 8-hour day. Well, now we all exceed the 8-hour day, but the 8-hour day includes an aversion response. And that means that you would sense that the infrared was hitting you, but we don't detect infrared, especially in a dark cab at night. So we don't put on sunglasses. We don't blink. Our pupils don't dilate. Or shrink up. They dilate the full 7 millimeter size, and the infrared comes in even stronger in a dark cab at night. I've explained all of this to the IBT. I explained all this to UPS. I've been to safety committee meetings. We brought all of the information in, and we brought a safety grievance. And all they want to do is come back with some rubber stamp, manufacturer thing of they're part of the IEC 62471, which when I read it, I laughed, because if you look at the exposure time, it states an aversion response, which I just explained to you we don't have. It states that no one should be in front of it for more than 8 hours and could be deemed safe, and that's with an aversion response. And then it said, get this, there is no safe known limits to anybody that is photosensitive. So you could be photosensitive just by nature. You know, you could be fair skinned, light eyed, and when you go out in the sun, you get burned, you get headaches, you have to wear sunglasses. You're probably on a borderline of being photosensitive. But then anybody's at risk, because there's 130 some odd medications and supplements. St. John's warts will give you horrible migraine headaches and stabbing pains in your eye in a reaction to infrared, artificial infrared. Regular NSAIDs, aspirins, Aleve, Tylenol, ibuprofen, all these things, you could have a bad day behind an infrared camera. And you know how I know this? Because it stated it in the IEC 62471. But UPS gave us no training. The union couldn't look out for us and say one simple thing, is it 100% safe? Because if a truck driver like me could find this stuff out just because I'm passionate about the other drivers I work with being injured and hurt, how come the people that we pay all this money to couldn't find this stuff out for us? And to this day, they won't even speak to me on it. And I'll tell you, if you get back in touch with Sean O'Brien, he could call me and I could explain this to him, if he's that much of a dum-dum, if you want to leave him my number, Steve.
That was Montana UPS long-haul driver Eric Johnson on ill health caused by AI infrared surveillance cameras in UPS trucks. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Thomas O'Rourke, Steve Zeltzer, and myself, Polina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.